Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, in this installment of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, we take a look at the relationship between slavery and capitalism. How did the commodification of human beings shape modern business management practices? We'll be joined by Dr. Caitlin Rosenthal, a historian and author of a new book called Accounting for Slavery, Master and Management. Plus, the big business of immigrant detention. Nearly 65% of ICE detainees are being held in privately owned detention centers. Who's profiting? And has the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy breathed new life into the for-profit prison industry? Dr. Sherry Parks and Midday Culture Connections, that's coming right up after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a nice Labor Day holiday weekend, and thanks for being with us today. We want to welcome you to another edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art, and today known as the Birthday Girl. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sherry. Happy birthday to you. Whoa, whoa. I always put the whoa, whoa in the end because it gives kind of a pop feel to
it. And now I have a recording of you doing that.
And the young people love it. And as a young person yourself, see, I just figured you would relate to it even better.
All right, keep it coming, Tom.
Keep it coming, keep it coming. Well, birthdays are good things to have, you know,
yes,
because
yes, the alternative
stinks. So I'm glad you're having one. Dr. Sherry Parks, of course, is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And she joins us on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. She is also the host of Beyond the Ballot here on WYPR, which airs twice a month on Thursday afternoons during All Things Considered. So, Sherry, coming up in a little bit, we're going to have a conversation about who's profiting from the increase in what's becoming the big business of detaining immigrants. So for more than 20 years, there has been a steady rise in the number of immigrants who are held at government and for-profit facilities across the country. So we'll talk about that later. But first, you wanted to talk about one of the legacies of the transatlantic slave trade that might not immediately come to mind for most people. Yeah. And that is the legacy between slavery and modern business management. That's a wild, wild notion, or at least it was to me before I started thinking about it.
Well, and I should say, I think of this show as the economics of suffering, because I think if we think of for evil, I'm from the South, so I can talk about evil, we often think of it as being embedded in one person. If we get rid of that one bad person, then we're okay. I think it's more important really to kind of look at the broader impact and influences of other people's suffering, and that there are generations who have profited from other people's sufferings, and that those practices, in this case accounting practices, the idea of commodifying everything and then keeping that data, is based on suffering. And then the other piece with immigration, small rural towns are banking on prisons, and they were emptying, and now they're turning to another population to fill those.
Yeah. So it is interesting because we think of slavery as this, you know, moral human outrage.
And it was.
Which, of course, it was. And the people, the individuals who were enslaved and treated so inhumanely and horribly. But there is something to learn about the business of these plantations and how they ran and how that has informed capitalism in our country and around the world ever since.
Well, yeah, because if you think of it as labor and absolute or almost absolute control of that labor, and then you want to know everything about that labor. And you can, one of the things I think that we'll talk about is how capitalism in its extreme looks, and then what happens as other employers strain toward that type of control. So it's not just accounting. There are business practices that were embedded in slavery that still inform labor relations today. Mm-hmm. And I think why I think that's important is that, you know, you've heard me say slavery is in the bones of the society. Well, you know, if you look at it from this perspective, it's not just the bones, it's the blood, it's the muscles. It's so deeply embedded that we can't pull it out. And certainly, superficially at least, you've heard me say, you know, that slavery set up the United States that we have today in terms of its economic power. This discussion says how. And that's really important.
And it's not just as simple as these plantation owners had free labor. I mean, it's not.
Well, it wasn't free.
But free to them in the sense that there were no recurring costs for labor. They paid a fee or a price for.
Well, they bought somebody.
They bought for the people they purchased, which is incredible. And they didn't pay them salaries.
Right.
So. Is because of that, because an enslaved person is such a sui generis, unique individual in the management structure, the organizational capitalist structure, does slavery itself give us a particular insight into capitalism that a normal management worker relationship would not give us?
Well, and I'm glad you started this out with how horrific slavery is, because I don't want this discussion at all to say, well, you know, it's kind of like what we have now, because that was one of the discussions at the time about how slaves had it better than Irish peasants. But there is a continuum of control of labor that slavery shows the extremes of. So they did have some recurring costs. I mean, they weren't spending exorbitant fees, obviously, but they were feeding people, they were housing people. And one of the reasons they were keeping such data is that they wanted to keep those costs as small as possible while extracting superhuman almost levels of labor out of every single person. So you begin to have this practice of commodifying slaves and then treating them. I mean, it was Thomas Jefferson who bundled his slave receipts, really, and selling them as a group, selling the almost the futures. He developed futures, for instance, the futures of the slaves, what they would produce. And so you begin to see many things that we do now, because slavery was such a, in yours, a very specific environment that allowed many activities to go almost unchecked. We see what happens and what people are willing to do in order to become wealthy, because at that time, In the South, if you wanted to become wealthy, slavery was almost the only way you could do it. And so people were willing to take extreme measures in order to get that wealth. And the idea that someone was suffering because of it almost often, come into play.
I mean, obviously, without slavery, a whole lot of things would not have happened. A whole lot of businesses would not have developed. But is it, known through data that absent slavery, if for some reason slavery had never come to the shores of this country, would cotton plantations have found it impossible to be profitable? I mean, is the notion of or the business of producing cotton in the quantities that it was produced in the 19th century just dependent on a labor force that was enslaved rather than a labor force that was employed?
Well, I'm glad you said the word quantity, because somebody would have been growing cotton. But what happened upon emancipation is those very big plantations broke up because they needed another labor source. So they couldn't just go purchase another, five human beings. And so they had to do something that looks more like modern day, what you would see in the North, what you would see in factories now, where they had to depend on people coming to work and being on time and doing those things. And so you did not have all of the negotiation that you would have unforced labor force. And yes, I mean, they broke up upon emancipation.
I want to welcome to our conversation Caitlin Rosenthal. She's an assistant professor of history at UC Berkeley out in California, and she's written a new book. It's called Accounting for Slavery, Masters and Management, in which she shows this correlation between modern finance and chattel slavery. She joins us on the line from her office in Berkeley. Dr. Rosenthal, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
By the way, listeners, if you'd like to join us and contribute to our conversation, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. So, Caitlin Rosenthal, the premise of your book, the purpose of the study, what were your aspirations when you went about researching the material for this book, which consists largely of original documents, the essentially the books, the P&L statements of slave owners and plantation owners in the 19th century?
So the goal of the book is really to write slavery back into the history of American business. When I started the research, I didn't intend to write a book about slavery, and I had been looking at at record books of all kinds of businesses in the 1800s, and somebody handed me record books for a plantation, and I was just amazed at how complex and complete they were. This wasn't true for all plantations, but some plantations kept immaculate records and were tracking productivity on a really precise level. And that surprise led me to start wondering whether slavery was more important to the history of business than I'd previously understood.
And, you know, Sherry Parks, when I read Caitlin's book, it was redolent of these precise and, as Caitlin describes them, immaculate records that the Nazis kept. You know, about this, the experiments that they were doing in concentration camps. There is this impulse. I mean, this was a business decision to keep track of all of these things, but still to you know, distance yourself from the human cost of what they were recording and what they were keeping data on takes some leap. I mean, it takes some moral, philosophical leap, unless they were just so, you know, so into this culture of human enslavement that they just lost track of what they were actually doing to people.
Well, I mean, and I want to get right back to Caitlin, but one of the things that I have noticed is the language and the similarity to the way that slaves were spoken of and the way horses were spoken of. That I have these beings on my farm. I buy and sell them. I may have some emotion about it, but in the end, this is a transaction. I think it's interesting. Caitlin comes from this from business. And so I think that perspective informs all of your work.
So I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the first thing that drew me to the records in a way was the extent of the quantification, and I think the quantification gave people a kind of comfortable distance from something that was really terrible. I mean, some of these records are kept by planters who are right on the plantation, but some of them were, for example, I use records from plantations in Jamaica kept by people who were reviewing the records from back in England, and I think they're able to pour through the numbers, and as Dr. Park said, they represent humans and animals in almost the exact same way. And I think it's quite a bit easier to do because the calculations give them this kind of comfortable distance where they can calculate with the goal of thinking about productivity and set aside all of the more complicated problems.
One of the first images that you have in the book, which is fascinating, is the cover of one of these books, and it speaks to that distance.
So one of the images that I found most disturbing and continue to find so troubling are these balance sheets kept in the unit of lives. I'm not sure if this is what you're referring to, but basically planters, instead of converting everything into dollars, they tally up the births and the deaths, and they just treat them as if the human life is a unit of analysis. And they seem to be able to do this without thinking very hard about the cost. So there's a balance sheet, and there are only a couple of births, and there are a huge number of deaths, and each death notes the reason. But because of the structure of the balance sheet, they can tout things up and reach a formal balance in a way that is really neat, even though the in terms of all kinds of human aspects, the balance sheet is really fundamentally unbalanced.
You mean neat as in tidy?
Exactly. I think the tidiness must have made it easier for people. I mean, one of the most striking things, I have records from an abolitionist who's writing against the slave trade, and he says, we need to be careful because apprentices aboard slave ships and agents on plantations get used to treating human beings no different from the way they treat seals or whales or animals. And that, like, the kind of getting used to thinking about lives in this really tidy, neat way actually is really dangerous for all kinds of other things. So it's like it's a reaction we have, but it's also they were well aware of the kind of benefits of the distance that the books could provide.
Well, and contributing to that is one of the images that you have in the book, where if you looked at the cover, you could not tell that it was about slaves. There was a lithographer who had these beautiful covers, and it looked like a librarian or an author might have used this book.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's a cover, the inside image from one of the account books. And it's made in New Orleans, the blank account book, and it just looks like anything you'd find in an office anywhere.
They were keeping track of the unit of lives, you know. And in fact, you write that the slaves were, in terms of the business data that they were collecting, they were the denominator against which production was measured. You make the example of Cuban sugars, which were measured in arrobas per negro, you know, the number of pounds or the quantity per person produced. The other thing that you bring up, that sometimes this accounting was done from afar. And this is, I guess, one of the first instances in business in which management was separate from the labor force. So management didn't have to be on site to keep track of things in this very, very acute way.
There's an idea that because plantation owners were absentee and that they weren't there, that they weren't paying attention. But some of these monthly reports suggest that they're paying a great deal of attention to how much profit they might be making. They're just doing it from a distance. So they're requiring someone to send them a monthly report and comparing month to month. And some people, planters, own multiple plantations, I mean, owning thousands of enslaved people. So they could make comparisons between their different plantations to see how they were doing.
And you write that the word control, Sherry was talking about this notion of controlling the labor force, and you write about this as well in the book. The word control actually comes from accounting practices, doesn't it?
Yeah, the word control comes from counter roll, and a counter roll was an account book kept as a check on another account book. And, you know, we still call the top accounting official in a lot of organizations the controller. And in a way, this is what got me interested in the topic to begin with. I found that people who were interested in business history tended to associate innovation with freedom and free choice. And I was seeing innovation associated with control and a lack of choice everywhere. So I was interested in writing about how violence and control really were more related to management innovation than we often realize.
Because they had absolute control over the labor.
Exactly. I think I mentioned that I started the project looking at books for free laborers, and people are just quitting all over the place. You know, it's such an important power to be able to quit, to be able to leave your job. And by contrast to these blanks and people departing from factories, planters were able to monitor enslaved people's labor every single day. Even when they don't monitor their labor, sometimes you know why not. They've noted that they're sick or that someone is giving birth, and you can see the way they're trying to get those people back to work as quickly as possible.
Well, on this show, we've done a couple of shows on discrimination of mothers and nursing mothers and pregnant women. So I was really interested in the idea of a suckler gang, because later, when they reverted to gang labor, they separated the women. Can you talk about what a suckler gang is?
So this really hit me as well, too. I had two children and was nursing two babies when I was writing the book. And I was just made me so acutely aware of the incredible control that people had over enslaved people's lives. So sometimes planters would establish a suckler's gang that worked at a different pace, like a slightly slower pace, and this allowed them to get people back to work when they were still nursing very young children. So they would have scheduled breaks where they could go and nurse their children. And you find plantation managers and people writing into the Southern press with their opinions about how long women should be allowed to work their children, how often babies need to eat. And this, you know, I think it really made me so aware of my own privilege as I was trying to raise my own children, because who knows how when a baby needs to eat. It was the mothers of those children, the people who are trying to, you know, provide for their children in this horrible circumstance. And here we have plantation owners trying to fit this into a regimented thing so that they can return people to work and kind of extract that labor as quickly as possible. You can see from the books also like how precious little time they're giving people off after they have their children, and the kind of ways they're able to extract more labor from enslaved women.
Because this really gets at how data can be used to predict and then control behavior. If no matter how much your baby cries, if the data says it's not ready to eat, you don't get to go feed it.
Yeah, if the expert opinion is that, you know, that baby only needs to eat, you know, at 9 o'clock at the same time as all the other babies after you've been working for 3 hours doing hard labor already, then, I mean, you just have an immense lack of control. One of the things people have written about the Reconstruction period, and one of the things I see from the plantation account books after the end of slavery, is I think that women and children are withdrawing their labor from the fields. And some of them are undoubtedly still working on farms, but they're not working under the eye of managers who are tracking data like with this minute precision. The kind of control of the data disappears. So like the most distinctive record from southern plantations to me is the record of cotton picking, where some planters track the amount of cotton every enslaved person picks every day. And that record, remarkably, almost completely disappears after emancipation. People just refuse to be measured and monitored the same way.
And this is where your work touches mine, because we often do not know that newly emancipated families took women out of the fields and children out of the fields as much as they could, so much so that in order for the man to get work as a tenant farmer or as a gang member, he often had to then agree that his wife would come back too.
Yeah, Reconstruction is such a difficult thing to watch, as you say, because on the one hand, you can see the power of that freedom where people are pulling women and children out of the fields. But that comes at such a high cost because the planters are able to maintain so much power through land and debt and violence.
And you write about the three basic inputs of production, which are land, labor, and capital. But of course, slaves were both labor and capital. So they had to be accounted for. They had to be, assessed in both ways. Some of these accounting techniques that we have that are in use to this day really started not in the factories of England and northern, the northeast United States, but in fact many decades prior during the time of slavery.
So the narrative I was used to about depreciation is that depreciation becomes common with large factories because they invest in long-lived capital assets. And they have to calculate those expenses over time. And there are not tons, but there are some and a significant number of examples of planters appreciating and depreciating enslaved people who are this ultimate complex, long-lived capital asset. And they're thinking about it in this way where they are assets from before they're born until after their deaths. There's a wonderful new book by Dana Ramey Berry about some of the same things I talk about, but she really digs into what it was like to be someone who was priced from before birth to after death.
There's one other really important point in your book that you take on historians for the way they've handled it. And your point is that there was a large and vibrant economy because of slavery, but you found that historians had not focused on that.
I mean, it's a really interesting gap in the knowledge. So I was quite surprised by what I found, but I found that also historians were often not so surprised. Like, there's some of these things that I think are well known in the history profession, but business historians haven't written about them, so they haven't brought this particular set of questions that illuminates the economic sophistication to it. And then there actually are people who have written about this, but the kind of story, I think, keeps getting erased. There's a really powerful article by a management scholar named Bill Cook where he says, look, this is the denial of slavery in business history. You know, he says he went to research business practices on slavery, and he could go read books about the history of slavery and tell, not without even going to the archives like I did, that these practices were really advanced. And given this, you know, the fact that it was so easy to find this information, it's particularly bad that we haven't really grappled with these business practices.
You write about a guy named Frederick Winslow Taylor, who is considered the founder of what's called scientific management. And you said that the pushback eventually to this scientific management practice was what we now call human relations. I mean, how did that pushback evolve? In other words, are there still direct corollaries between management practices, induction or inducements of laborers and workers to produce more now? Is there a direct lineage between slavery and what's going on in the corporate world and the manufacturing world now?
So, I mean, I was really initially when I started the project interested in looking for direct links. And there are a handful of links. For example, Henry Lawrence Gantt, who I write about a little bit, and he's the founder of the Gantt chart. He was born at the very end of slavery on a plantation in Maryland. And there are a handful of other examples. But I actually came to think that trying to find the smoking gun was the wrong way to go about it. Like when you go back to earlier in the 1800s, you know, I had been reading the records of textile mills, and of course all the cotton that these textile mills that are so sophisticated is weaving into cloth is being grown by enslaved people. So I went from looking for a direct genealogy to realizing that the ties were just everywhere. You know, I was searching for a kind of needle in a haystack smoking gun, and the more powerful point is that these two economies were just deeply connected at every stage.
We've got to take a little break, but Caitlin Rosenthal, if you could stick around for just a couple more minutes, it'd be great to continue and finish our conversation when we come back from a little break. Caitlin Rosenthal is an assistant professor of history at UC Berkeley. She studies 18th and 19th century American history. The new book is called Accounting for Slavery, Masters and Management. Dr. Sherry Parks is with me here in Studio A. Coming up next, after we finish our conversation with Caitlin Rosenthal, we'll talk about the business of immigrant detention, but we will finish our discussion of slavery and accounting and capitalism when we come back from this quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks from the Maryland Institute College of Art. Our guest is Caitlin Rosenthal, who joins us on the line from Berkeley, California. She's the author of a new book called Accounting for Slavery, Masters and Management. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at Midday. WIPR. Let's go to the phones. Dave in Baltimore, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot for taking my call. I was wondering whether the author was familiar with a book by Edward Baptist Cornell, Professor, The Half That's Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. I believe he mentions Goldman Sachs became an economic powerhouse by insuring slaves in Mississippi, and that Mississippi was the richest state in the nation prior to the Civil War. I was curious about her comments on that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. Dr. Rosenthal, what do you think? Are you familiar with that book?
I am familiar with Professor Baptist's book, and I don't know the specific example the caller mentioned, but I would say that this is a huge area of new research where people are trying to get to the bottom of the financial infrastructure of slavery. So there's Sharon Murphy is working on a book on enslaved mortgages. Michael Ralph and Bill Rankin have written about slave insurance. And there's a wonderful book by a man named Richard Kilbourn where he talks about how debt relations and slavery. And one of the arguments that's made in some of these contexts is that enslaved people were actually a boost to the financial economy. So they could become collateral on loans. They were a really fluid and flexible form of capital. So they helped people to get access to more debt and more credit, and thus kind of led to kind of greater financial infrastructure. So it's a really big and growing area of research where the kind of finance of the slave economy, we're just beginning to understand how important it was.
And in your concluding chapter, you write that management expertise blended well with violence. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the innovation was something we associate generally with free choice. And here I saw it as something growing out of planters' control over enslaved people. I mean, even down to like a technology like the whip. And we don't even think about whips as a technology. But if you read enslaved people's narratives, you find that special whips were used by slave traders because they never wanted to leave a mark on enslaved people before they had to sell them. But on a plantation, someone might not care about leaving a mark, or a scar might even be an impetus for people to work faster and harder. And these interconnections between technology, between data and violence are something we don't spend a lot of time thinking about. We tend to think about technology as computers and steam engines and forget about some of the ways that technology can blend with violence instead or in addition.
It's like staging a house.
I mean, yeah,
you would
exactly.
stage this life. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You've experienced a little pushback to this endeavor in general, not just the book, but the way you're approaching the study of slavery and its relationship to capitalism and to business. Why do you think that is? What have your critics cited, and how do you respond?
Well, I think some people wonder why this might have, like, what does this have to do with business today? Like, if these methods aren't directly connected to an individual business, why do we care about this? And I think there's two big reasons. One is that if we dig a little deeper in American history and the history of American business, you find almost everything is in some way connected through finance or through cotton to the history of slavery. So I think slavery's everywhere. The other thing is that that's just not the right criteria. So let's say people love to read biographies of Andrew Carnegie. They love to read those biographies even when they don't work in steel. We like to read the biographies that make us feel good about our business practices. We like to read biographies of people who kept exceptional records. So what I set out to do was to write a history of planters who had exceptionally good business practices, the kind of people who we would be writing about and reading about if they were in a more pleasant industry. And the goal of that is to make people feel really uncomfortable with the compatibility of business practices to something truly terrible that we should be spending, I think, a lot more time as a nation talking about slavery.
Well, it's certainly something that never even occurred to me before Dr. Parks brought it to my attention. And then having read your book, it's a fascinating study. So thank you for your time and appreciate it.
Well, thank you both. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Caitlin Rosenthal from the University of California at Berkeley. The new book is called Accounting for Slavery, Masters and Management. Dr. Sherry Parks is with me here in Studio A. It's Midday Culture Connections. Coming up next, the business of immigrant detention. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back. And welcome back. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. I'm Tom Hall. But before we continue our program today, each week here on our show, on Mondays usually, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So we were on vacation last week and yesterday, so we want to share with you today the names of the people that we've lost in our city during the past 2 weeks. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of Baltimore homicide victims going back 17 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list and the victim identifications that are posted on the Baltimore Police Department's Facebook page. So far in 2018, 198 people in Baltimore City have been victims of homicide. Two previously unidentified victims have now been named by police. They are Christopher Brown, age 57, and Michael Smith, age 40. During the past 2 weeks, police report that 11 people lost their lives to violence in our city. They are Varu Green, age 24, James Williams, age 62, Michael Gethers, age 37, John Johnson, age 45, Tiffany Jones, age 29, Jarrell Shaw, age 31, Darrell Jackson, age 34. Marcus Brown, age 18. Antoine Nelson, age 25. Pierre Jones, age 30. And Dorothy Neal. She was 83 years old. And now we continue our midday culture connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, who joins me here in Studio A. By the way, Sherry Parks will be leading an Afterthoughts conversation at Baltimore Center Stage later this month on Thursday, September 27th, following a performance of the Tennessee Williams classic, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Sherry's going to discuss white segregation culture in America in the 1950s. That sounds like it'll be fun. You're doing a couple of these this year, right?
Yeah, two or three of them.
Yes. Yeah, after the various performances of various productions over at Center Stage. If you're just joining us today, we're now going to start discussing the business of immigrant detention and the cities and industries that are profiting from the internment of immigrants and asylum seekers. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @midday WYPR, to follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. You must have a Twitter handle as well. Sherry, what is it?
@SherryParks.
@SherryParks. Imagine that. The birthday lady herself, @SherryParks. So this is really quite a fascinating thing that people have been writing about over the summer and, you know, for the past really couple of years. The relationship between ICE and putatively the cities and towns that they are contracting with to have facilities to detain immigrants, but in fact these government entities, these cities and towns, are jobbing that duty out to for-profit detention companies. This is a very interesting stickly wild web, isn't it?
And it really starts in the 1970s on, where small towns, mostly rural, mostly Midwest, were experiencing economic decline. And they began to look toward prisons as a way of making money, of reaching out. And so there, it peaked in the 1990s. But, I mean, between 1970 and 2000, the number of prisons went from 511 to over 1,600. So you have this idea that you have people out of work, prisons are full, but you really begin to have this really awful process where you have an association that is lobbying for longer prison sentences in order to keep those prisons full of mostly people of color, certainly mostly of people who are poor. And then after the Obama began to lessen the sentencing guidelines, they began to have empty beds. And very much like the conversation we just had, an empty bed is loss of revenue. And so they tend to not talk about people, they talk about beds. And so what happens when those beds go empty, you begin to have them being filled by contracts with ICE, so that now, rather than the public prisons, which are the majority in which Americans are housed, 65%, and I'm quoting both the New Yorker and the Marshall Project, which is a nonprofit journalism about criminal justice organization, so that now 65% of all ICE immigration cases are housed in for-profit prisons. And so they're often not able to make the switch from the very punitive way in which we treat inmates to a less punitive way of treating immigrants. And so we begin to get those really hard cases that are starting to come to light about the way immigrants have been treated.
Yeah, because there's supposed to be a distinction between detaining someone,
yes,
while their asylum case or immigration case is heard, and imprisoning somebody,
yes,
as punishment for some putative crime. Newsweek had a piece a couple of months ago, earlier this summer, about the town of Adelanto, which is a town in California. It's in San Bernardino County. They signed an agreement in 2014 to provide guard services for the so-called family detention center that was in New Mexico for a year. So the town, this Adelanto, gets into this contract with the Immigration Service of the United States to run a prison or a detention center that's not even in their town.
Right.
It's like they're the fiscal agent or something for this.
Well,
thing.
They're the broker.
Yeah. So here they are in California, and they're supposedly running a detention center in New Mexico.
And they pass it on to, and it's hard to talk about people in these terms, but they go from wholesale to retail. So they're outsourcing the retail, because that's the way, when I say that, I'm not being offensive, but there are associations where people come and figure out how to get the most money out of this situation. And so, you know, how to spend as little as possible on care and maximize as much as you can by having more of these contracts. It doesn't work. The economic model has been shown to yield very little for that town. But towns are desperate, and they're looking for a way. And much like slavery, and I am making this connection, much like slavery, they're looking to capitalize on suffering.
And it's not like this town in California sends a group of people who are on the town payroll to New Mexico to run the detention center. They don't do that at all. They job it out. In this case, it's a thing called the GEO Group. This is a for-profit prison. It's one of two for-profit prison companies who, for example, their market value, their value in the stock market, is outperforming the rest of the stock market. The stocks are very high in for-profit prisons now, and this is a stock market that's booming, that's doing very, very well. And as well as the market is doing overall, for-profit prisons are doing even better.
Well, because the model does work to the benefit of the company, not the towns. So, I mean, we've introduced two models, and we should separate them out. There are those who are hoping to bring jobs to their town. And then, as you point out, there's a more, I'll use the word, sophisticated economic model where they just get a fee for transferring this to a company that has lots of these. But there is a forced labor aspect here where you can have prison workers work for pennies, literally pennies, but then you turn around much like tenant farming, because it's like slavery and like tenant farming, where you then charge those people more for the goods and services. So prisoners often supplement their diet with food for the commissary. Well, the food purchased at a commissary, which these companies control, is five times what it costs in general society. So they have these, they take the benefits of forced labor, and then they take the benefits of tenant farming and put them together, and you have a very profitable plan.
There are allegations in a lawsuit brought by people who have been detained in centers like this that the companies are forcing immigrant detainees to perform unpaid labor.
Yes.
So that's part of the thing. Of course, the company denies it. In one facility, there was one janitor for a 1,500-bed facility. It's in Colorado. So instead of hiring workers to, you know, maintain the detention center, they are using the people who are being detained to do that. And as you say, doing things like charging them exorbitant fees to buy food. There's a Newsweek quotes a woman named Judy Morell, who was a nurse who worked at a place, one of these private facilities. And she says that food for detainees was scarce. It was different. She told stories of feeding people chicken bones and rice because they just simply did not. They cut costs by not feeding people. This is happening now. This is happening within the last, you know, couple of years. And of course, the purpose of this originally was, I guess, kind of made sense. And it was originally thought that ICE would piggyback onto these detention centers that towns were already running. The idea was, rather than reinvent the wheel, if there is a detention center that is, as you said, lightly populated or had space available, they figured this local government's already doing it, so that they would contract with the local government to take some of these immigrant detainees. But even that, That's a really difficult model because, as we mentioned, there is this distinction between imprisoning somebody and detaining somebody while they're in the immigration system. But if they're in the same building, how do you do that?
Well, the same building, the same staff, the same supplies. I mean, so it's set up that way. But one of the things we also have to point out is that this trend parallels the demise of treating prisoners as people to be rehabilitated. And I mean, that happened during this, has been happening in the same period. So they're entering more punitive prisons than they would have if this had been the 1970. So we're talking about operations that are not set up to treat people in any way humanely. And without a huge influx of cash, which a for-profit company doesn't have the incentive to do, the contracts evidently are not mandating a different level of care. They don't.
And of course, the argument for the for-profit prison is that they can provide the detention of immigrants at a lower cost. So one estimate has it at about $144 per inmate per day versus $184, so 40 bucks more in a federally run immigration detention center. But there does seem absolutely to be a spike. The Trump administration's zero tolerance policy has been good for business, has it not?
So let's reinfuse the human into this. The process doesn't. So you're talking about people who have been traumatized one way or the other. Even if many of them are seeking asylum, so they've been traumatized in that way. The trek across the border is itself traumatized, and then when they get to the United States, and I'm not arguing about the law. They are further traumatized. And we haven't even touched upon the separation of children, which we and so now that families.
So now the families are putatively being held in together, at least.
Right. But they're being held in these same spaces.
Right.
So the human aspect of this happening, as you said, now is really important. But the conversation is about beds. So it is dehumanized. Yet again.
Yeah, and we're talking about, as of last November, 41,000 beds, right?
It's huge. So,
I mean, it's a lot of people. And of course, what happens is when this gets jobbed out to a private company, ICE, the people who are, you know, ultimately paying for this, lose all accountability. I mean, it's very difficult to pin any mistreatment or illegal, unconstitutional treatment on the officials at ICE because they're not physically doing it.
And of course, this is a system that doesn't even know where some of the children are anymore. Remember, they're having trouble reuniting families.
Oh, yeah. This is supposedly these families are being reunited, but they by no means have all been reunited as we speak.
So if you can't account for even where the children are, how can you account for the care that they're being given?
The lineage, as you say, goes way back. But there doesn't seem to be any movement. I mean, there's a great immigration advocacy community that's grown up, particularly since the zero tolerance policy. But boy, in this specific political climate now, the Trump administration is all for private prisons.
Well, because it's good for business.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a business. And that is the bottom, pun intended, the bottom line.
Yeah, literally the bottom line. So we talked a little bit today about bottom lines with Dr. Sherry Park. She is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And she joins us every month for Midday Culture Connections. Happy birthday again, and I'll see you next time.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Join us tomorrow for a program of Sonnets and Slam as we welcome five exceptional talents from Baltimore and the international poetry scene. Michael Collier, he's the former Poet Laureate of Maryland, and Goucher College professor Elizabeth Spires will share some work from their new poetry collections. And Victor Rogers, Carolina Lee Connor, and Delicia Green of the Dumore Baltimore Youth Poetry Team join us. They are part of the team that won the 2018 International Poetry Slam this summer, and they'll show us why they are the number one slam poets in the country tomorrow, coming up on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall, out of the blocks, coming up right after the news at the top of the hour with Aaron Hinken. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.